The start of the week and plenty to catch your ear on the radio. From the challenges of growing up deaf in Ireland to finding the good in the lockdown and the Gunplot podcast. This is Playback Daily. I'm Carol Moran and here's what you might have missed.
My son is so wanted inside the front door of my house. But when he steps outside that front door, this country that I love with my heart, my soul, my being doesn't want my son.
Conspiratorial thinking increases when people feel uncertain or when they feel angry or scared or distrustful. So the pandemic has really, it's kind of created a perfect storm for conspiracy theories to take hold.
Yes, I am a Catholic and I personally would give 10% of my income to the Catholic Church.
And we'll start in the morning on the Ryan Tuberty Show, the challenges for deaf children and their families in Ireland. After Ryan mentioned the Oscar-nominated film Sound of Metal about a man losing his hearing, Ryan spoke to Andrew Geary, and it's Andrew's ferocious love and absolute resolve to ensure all of his children have the very best chance to reach their potential that made this interview so special and so enlightening.
I suppose I want to go begin our chat, if you don't mind, to go back to the 19th of November 2008, a great day in your life as the two lads arrived into your world, Callum and Dunica.
That's, yeah, we were twins born that day. We have two older boys, Barry and Matthew, and Callum and Dunica were born on that day. And anyone that has twins or multiple births, you know that's a really special day in anyone's life.
Of course. And the two lads were, I presume, swimming along at the same pace in the same pool, as it were, for a fair amount of time.
Yeah, and I suppose to link in with your story, Ryan, what happened in 2011, we found out that Callum was deaf. And a few months later, we found out that he had no auditory nerve. Therefore, that stopped the cochlear implant being a choice for us as a family to make. We did travel the world to try to give him some environmental sound through another implant that's known as an auditory brainstem implant. However, we found out, despite the great work of people in Manchester, London, Warsaw and Los Angeles, that was completely ineffectual. All throughout that journey, we, Helen and I and our kids, we would have been learning sign language and we've been welcomed with open arms into that deaf sign language community.
My question is to go back to 2008, the lads were born, and then 2011, 3 years later, you discovered that, I suppose, that Callum was deaf. What? How do you know that when your baby is deaf?
I suppose the benefit today, Ryan, is there's newborn screening, so there'll be a test done at birth.
Really?
That wasn't in place in 2008. So every child born today will be tested before they leave the maternity ward. That wasn't in place. Ireland was one of the last countries in Europe to bring that in, but it's successfully brought in, I believe, in all parts of the maternity sector now.
Yeah.
And so Callum would have passed kind of one or two tests at home, but we knew something was wrong as parents. He wasn't our first child and we had his twin alongside him. And basically, he's such a bright visual child. He passed hearing tests, believe it or not, even though he's no auditory nerve, so he's never heard a sound in his life. But his vision in the back of his head, he's just unbelievable spatial awareness. And they had to put him under anaesthetic and it came back then that he was completely deaf as anyone can possibly be. There's no 1%. And then they did another check in Beaumont a few months later to confirm that he was missing his whole auditory nerve.
What does that do to you as parents in terms of being told that news?
It's very similar to watching that movie. You go through those grieving stages and that anger and that acceptance, and then you grow to love it. And it's, as Riz Ahmed put the role very well for people, it's the same as any parent of a child. You bring this absolutely perfect bundle of life into your world and then you're defined by what you've seen before, and then a new definition comes in and then deafness becomes part of Callum's identity, and that's where the next part of our journey took off, I suppose.
Tell me what you mean by defined by what you've seen before.
I suppose I had no experience of deafness whatsoever. Mm-hmm. My mother can remember me playing with some deaf kids when I was a child, but I can't remember that myself. But, and you just don't know what it is to live in that bubble, because the deaf live in a total island on our island, and until you come in to that island, you've no idea what type of life it is. And it's the same for any parent with any special needs or different ability child. It's, you go into that world and you have to open the door and take one baby step at a time till you understand what journey you're now on.
And Ryan asked Andrew about Callum now that he is 12.
12, 13 is a very important age in a child's life, because you're really starting on the road to adulthood at that point, and you've got an awareness of the world that is generally underestimated, I think, by society at large. So where are you now with him? Where is he now with his future? Because he's now of that age where he's mature enough to start articulating himself.
Something happened a few weeks ago, Ryan, and it basically shook Helen and I to the absolute core. Callum is such a bright, humorous, he's such a laugh, a sense of humour. He just loves life, loves people, loves going to school, loves his family, his dogs, his walks, cycling. But he said to us the other day, you know, just a few weeks ago, just such a coincidence, your team rang me that week. And he said, "Mom, Dad, I've something to tell you." And we have a very open relationship with all of our kids. And he said, it was almost like a sit-down moment. We didn't get to sit down. He just said, "I'm never going to have a job, you know." And we said, "Why? You know, we always encourage our kids. We love education and we love our kids." And we said, "Why?" He said, "It's because I'm deaf." And he just walked off and left the conversation there. Mm-hmm. Of course, we came back to it, but like that's earth-shattering.
Yeah. I mean, what do you do with that? What did you do with that, Andrew?
Well, you just come back to it. I've been working hard on this for a long, long time. And it just taught me that basically a lot of my efforts have been useless. But it just says to me, "Dad, get down. You got to do a whole lot more work. Doesn't matter what you've done in the past. There's a whole lot more to be done." Because, Ryan, he's telling the truth. And I know that. Like, we had friends of mine help me organise a conference a few years ago. And I gave an opening address there. And some of my friends are brilliant. They're coders, they're deaf, and they gave me great assistance. And I just spoke about being a father, Helen and I doing our best as his parents. And everyone stood up and cried, waved their arms and the deaf applause. And people just kept coming to me, thanks. I said, "You don't owe me anything. All I am doing is the job of my son's father, nothing else." They said, "I wanted you as my dad." I said, "I'm a failure. You don't want me." But the pain that's there, Ryan, in our deaf community, they're living in an island, in a bubble, not wanted. My son is so wanted inside the front door of my house. But when he steps outside that front door, this country that I love with my heart, my soul, my being, doesn't want my son. And I ask myself every day, I wake up, it's my first thought in the morning. "You're a failure, Gary. What did you do today? What are you going to do today? Go to sleep at night. What did you do today?" There's an island of 5,000 people there, and they have nothing. We might have given them an act. We gave them UNCRPD. They're still begging.
You went around the world looking for a solution when Callum was a baby. Is that right?
Yeah.
You organised a conference for like-minded souls to talk this through. Is that right?
Yeah.
No man is a failure who does that.
I can't agree with you. I've achieved nothing.
Well,
absolutely nothing.
I think you're being very hard on yourself. I think you sound like a kind, compassionate human being who loves his son and all his sons and his wife with a passion and a dignity that is the like of which I don't remember seeing for a long, long time. and your uses of the word be useless and failure strike me as being the words of somebody who's being really, really tough on themselves. You have a beautiful family. You're a loving dad. As one dad to another, let me tell you, like, I aspire to be as good as you are. So, honest to goodness.
I appreciate.
I mean that. That's not that fatuous, glib plumas.
I just have been given a gift.
Yeah.
An absolute gift.
Well, that's
and
way.
I don't feel worthy of that gift, Ryan. I've been given a beautiful language.
Yeah.
A beautiful community, and I don't feel worthy.
And Ryan asked Andrew about his work serving as a Garda sergeant.
I'm a sergeant in Garda Síochána, and it's an absolutely, you can't ask for a better, more rewarding, demanding role. And I love my job. I can go out there genuinely and apply myself with humility and hard work and try to bring some honour to that uniform.
Mm. Which you do. You love this strange but beautiful country we live in.
I do.
Yeah.
And I think we live, our community, just we go abroad, and I've been given that privilege of representing my job abroad. This country is just loved because we communicate, we listen. The community workers in this country, the advocates, the charities, the volunteers, this country is built on their backbone, and we are nothing without those people. They just give their absolute heart, soul, being every day without thanks. And that's what I love about this country. Just, we went for a cycle yesterday in Donrail Park, and just people saying hello, getting their eyes up, saying hello, how are you? It's a beautiful day. You don't get that elsewhere. And like when I had that privilege of representing my job abroad, they just love us. And I love my country too, but my country doesn't love my son.
When do you see that writ at the most large? When do you see it most obviously when you think that the country doesn't love...
In education.
In education, okay. So give me your main problem with the education of not just Callum, but of friends like him.
I tell you, our story is simple. We've twins. Both boys are bright, and we know that because we almost had to prove Callum's intelligence, and NEPs were brilliant to us, and they gave us great support with that. And but, like, Dunica can read, he's reading Lord of the Rings at the moment, and he's really enjoying that. All my kids, we've bookshelves everywhere, and Callum is reading Roald Dahl, but still he wants more.
Yeah.
And that's thanks to, now, I would not knock Callum School. They're brilliant people.
Yes.
The system has left my child down because I need full access to fluent, flowing sign language, the likes of Amanda Coogan that you have on the Late Late Toy Show at Christmas. Someone that brings the language to life, that loves the language. We've brilliant interpreters here in Cork, and the school's hands are tied behind their back. I can't expect the teachers to teach him at, you know, they didn't go to college learning sign language. They've done the classes to absolute immense credit to most of them. They've done them on their own time and brought it to a high enough level as they can on their own time.
So they're speaking almost, if I may, like pidgin sign language, as we would.
That's exactly it.
And they're giving it a go, like you might if you're on holidays in France with your bit of leaving cert friend. And you admire their commitment to the task, but then you see Amanda on the toy show, and with the joy she brings to it and the clear experience of it, you want teachers to speak fluent.
And I'm not even looking for that, Ryan. I just want an interpreter to stand next to the teacher. I can't expect that teacher to go to Trinity College Dublin for 4 years to become an interpreter. But I just want, give me an interpreter that stands next to the teacher. Callum's had brilliant, and I just mean brilliant, teachers in St. Columbus, in Cork. Brilliant people, brilliant professionalism that have given their heart and soul. But Callum needs more. He needs a bridge, that bridge to his potential, because there's a fire in his eyes that is, and I just need to set fire to that, to open that to its full flowing. It hurts him. He sees the books his brothers can pick up. He's just as bright. And he works very hard. My wife works really hard, Helen. We read, the whole family, we read together. and we sit down together. Everyone picks up a book, and he just wants, and he's really hard on himself. But I've been trying for 6 years. We have our sign language act, we have UNCRPD, but they're talking about creating this role forever, and there's all lovely flowing words like reasonable access. Callum has had whatever this reasonable access is for 8.5 years, and he's years behind his twin brother.
Andrew Geary from The Ryan Tuberty Show. And in the morning, the very disturbing scenes from India as COVID tears through the country. Here's Gavin Jennings.
International efforts are underway to help India as the country suffers critical oxygen shortages amid a devastating surge in COVID cases. India reported almost 350,000 more cases in the 24 hours to yesterday morning and another 2,767 deaths. However, the true figures are thought to be much higher. Dr. Harshit Singh Batty works at the Manipal Hospital in Delhi. He's been describing what conditions are like there.
We are not able to provide oxygen to the patients and they are dying. Like, means I don't want to compare, but the situation is like, have you seen the fish out of water? The situation is same as the people who are dying, struggling for oxygen. They were not getting oxygen and they are dying on roads. Many of our patients need ventilator. Many of the patients need high flow oxygen. But because another patient is on the bed and they are on ventilator, so we are not able to provide ventilator to other patients. It is a, when I am inside my high dependency unit, that is HDU. So we are in the, like, we are in a dual mindset. That when one patient expires, we don't have a time to grieve for them. We don't have a time to cry for them. We just have to wrap up their body and just clean the bed and put another patient on that bed with a ventilator. So that's why I have written on my social media also that we are now, our mental status is like that we are feeling a dual sort of emotions. One, grief for my lost patient, and a relief for my another patient which is gasping for breaths, and we are putting them on ventilator in a hope that they might survive and we can save one patient.
That's Dr. Harshit Singh Batty at the Manipal Hospital in Delhi. Let's speak to Rahul Bedi. He's the Irish Times correspondent based in New Delhi. Rahul Bedi, good morning. Thanks for taking our call today.
Good morning.
The footage from India viewing is very difficult, particularly for families here, for people here who have families in India. Can you describe what conditions are like there at the moment?
Well, as the doctor said, the situation is really apocalyptical. I mean, the people are waiting in queues outside hospitals. A lot of them are being turned away. And the grimmer side of the situation is really that cremations are being carried out in public parks, in parking lots. People are being buried in public parks because the graveyards are overflowing. There's a waiting list for cremation grounds. And as the doctor said, people are struggling for oxygen. A lot of the hospitals all over the country, in fact, have oxygen reserves of no more than 2 or 3 hours. And scores of people are dying by the hour because they just do not have either oxygen or the ability to get into any hospital.
What is India going to do?
Well, the government is trying desperately. I mean, the government is really responsible for this catastrophe, because it's a combination really of hubris of Mr. Modi's government, which in February and March had declared that they'd seen the end of the COVID and that India had battled COVID in a remarkable manner. And they did not anticipate a second wave, which was staring them really in the face. And they're now desperately scrambling around for oxygen from Russia, from Germany, from Europe, from the United States. The Indian Air Force has been deployed to send its transport aircraft to get oxygen plants. And hopefully something would work out by the end of the week. But in the meantime, there are hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands, of patients who are likely to die.
Journalist Rahul Bedi in New Delhi speaking to Gavin Jennings on Morning Ireland. Then later on today with Claire Byrne, reporter Evan O'Rourke was talking to the Indian community in Dublin.
Yeah, we are very in the family back home. My brother, they are elderly, and my sister-in-law are elderly, you know. But we are in touch with them almost every day. There are a huge amount of people here, and I'm sure that most of the people will have somebody either in their village or in their town or in the locality they were living in. They had COVID or they are died of COVID, you know. Because we believe in the extended families, you know. So like the Irish one, and they will know and they will mourn and they will be concerned, you know. That is what is happening.
We are talking to home every day, and especially because I'm worrying about the parents, we asked the family and they said, okay, we are also far all fine, you know. They're more worrying about the getting in the hospitals and beds and admissions, you know, like that. That is make more, you know, kind of, you know, the worry to everyone's like that, you know. But thanks to God now that, you know, that some supports is, you know, coming from that, you know, the from the world and, you know, from the Germany and EU and UK and USA and Ireland itself, you know, part of that EU. So hopefully that's the situation will come to the, you know, soon. And we all be together in this, you know, the situation in the pandemic.
You must feel very far away.
Yeah. And yes, I do. Yeah. And I was getting yesterday from some of my Irish friends, those who are here. And they're also texting me and giving that, you know, the hope and all that, you know, strength, all that, you know. And they were asking how your family, how
they are. So your Irish friends here are supporting you here.
Yeah, supporting, yeah, exactly. So really that's make, you know, more, you know, kind of things, you know, we are all part of that, you know. Everyone have the concerns about that, you know. So they know that the situation is bad. Everybody, even when I work in the hospital, my patient has asked how the situation in India, how your family like that, you know.
Evelyn O'Rourke's report from today with Claire Byrne. And in the afternoon, Anne Collins called a live line about a story that churches were being helped financially to pay for equipment to broadcast Mass.
I see a priest, a Tipperary priest, is queried by the government, this is from the Irish Catholic, the government will be financially supporting clergy who have invested in webcams in order to move their services online. Father Michael Toomey, PP of Ardfinn and Newcastle, told the Irish Catholic he spent €5,000 setting up a webcam to broadcast Masses to his parishioners, and collections are down. And what do you think? Should the government help pay for church facilities for broadcasting to people at home?
No, I think they should contact the Vatican, their head office, one of the richest countries in the world, for their assistance. Because there's people out there that are donating their last few euros, pensioners and that, to support the church, which they have a huge company, one of the biggest ones in the world, running the Catholic Church. So I think they should just go to the mother company and ask for the money.
Well, that's Anne there, and Sheila was listening in Waterford, and she called Jo about supporting her church financially.
Well, I heard briefly what you were talking about, Jo, on the way home, and it was just saying about should we support the church. That priest this morning was saying, is it he spent 5,000? Mm-hmm. I believe, yes, I am a Catholic, and I personally would give 10% of my income to the Catholic Church in various ways. Maybe some ways would be supporting the obviously my parish priest, my Jews, and then obviously various things that would take place, you know, helping, you know, different other charities under the, like, folk work, different things like that. I have done for a number of years. And I think it's the least that we can do, because each parish, I'm just speaking as a Catholic, we should be supporting our priests. Because they have given their lives for us, shall we say, to shepherd us.
I understand that. But Sheila, did you say, do you calculate 10% of your income to give?
To be honest, Joe, it works out more. It gives out more. How that started was I went on a retreat in my very early 30s.
Okay.
And the priest that gave the retreat, it was a week-long retreat, Father Bill, if now Father Anthony would do it. Father Bill has now died. And that retreat, I'll be honest, changed my life. Completely. In a very positive way.
Okay.
It taught me how to got the faith very real for me. And in one of the discussions was tithing, where a person would give 10% of their income.
Tithing, yeah.
Tithing, well done. For the for example, I'm a Catholic saint for maybe, actually, Protestants would be quite good at this. That was years ago. I remember quite a few of my Protestant friends would say, oh, should we do that normally? And where to me it was completely, I never heard of it, even though I was born a Catholic. But I would find it, yes, it's. I think it's the least that we can do. And I can honestly testify in my own life that God's exceptionally generous. What you give, you will get back a hundredfold. And I personally can testify to that.
Well, that's Sheila there. Then Bridget wanted to make a point about church finances.
I just want to say, you know, there was a reference made there, we say, to the wealth the church has and so on in the Vatican, and, right? But that's very distant from us. I mean, I have heard in recent times of priests in their parish starting a local lotto to try to fill up the gap that there has been in their income. Now, to me, it's kind of demeaning for priests to have to go down that route to get income to run a parish.
But Bridget, if I was to say, could they raise income by an awful pay per view? That if you want to subscribe to the local church, you have to pay to get a password or whatever, so you can watch.
And then you're probably hitting the most vulnerable in the community again. Because we all know that the highest number of viewers are among the older section of the population, and they're the people you're going to be asking to contribute again. And I mean, in our own parish, we've been fortunate in that people have continued to be generous throughout all of this. But if you go looking for extra money within the parish, you're likely to be going back to the very same people again.
That's Bridget on the live line with Joe Duffy. And on today with Claire Byrne, conspiracy theories and the effects on families. Reporter Brian O'Connell was looking at the issue in the morning.
I mean, we've always had the likes of anti-vax, anti-5G, far-right conspiracy communities. And I suppose they existed as distinct groupings before COVID in many cases. But I think what COVID has done, it's allowed some people who believe in these different unproven theories to unite behind a single issue. And social media has obviously played a significant role here and has hugely fueled the dissemination of these theories and groups. Algorithms are pushing certain material into people's news feeds every single day. And while it's still a minority of people who hold these views, I think you're right in saying we're not talking anymore about people on the fringes in darkened rooms. I mean, these are people, some of them who go about their day-to-day normal lives, working on the front line, for example, but they're finding like-minded people online to amplify their beliefs. And the worry is that some of them may retain these beliefs long after COVID leaves us.
And you've been meeting and talking to some people who are struggling with some of the beliefs that those close to them have taken on during the pandemic.
Exactly. Now, let's begin with one of those I spoke to, who is Sean. And Sean has seen some people he knows quite well push COVID conspiracy theories during the past 12 months.
I've come across friends and family who seem to have like just fallen down this rabbit hole of these kind of current COVID-related conspiracy theories. And like, I've watched close families, especially on Facebook, they seem to like, share and comment and all sorts of what I just say is nonsense. Bill Gates, 5G vaccines and whatnot. I feel bad for them because on the one hand, like the lockdowns, they've been really hard on everyone.
Are these people, are these family members and friends that you would have had concerns about previously before COVID?
To be honest, no. For the most part, I would have said they would have kind of stuck on the news and believed most of what they seen. But now it really seems to have turned complete 180, I suppose. They don't trust half of what that's been said anymore. It's just like they're ruled by the mob on Facebook, honestly, nowadays. It's a bit mad to me to see. The longer this goes on, I feel like the more people seem to be falling into this and not caring about guidelines and restrictions. One person I know, I remember at the start of this pandemic, it was very much the case of OTT, over the top, like food shopping was getting cleaned when you came in. Shoes were all getting wiped down and taken off. Phones were getting wiped down. And this person now has flat out refused this vaccine. They don't trust in it at all. They don't believe in it. Whereas before, at the start of the pandemic, they would have been praying for it to have come one day.
What kind of ways do you tackle it?
I find it really difficult to try and debate with someone that, from my point of view, just doesn't believe a credible or a reliable sort. I don't know what can be done about it. It'll be an issue, I think, that'll carry on for a good few years.
Does it put a strain on those friendships that you had?
Oh, for sure.
And Brian spoke about the echo chamber of social media.
Well, essentially what we're talking about really is a case of digital confirmation bias. So what I mean by that is people are picking and choosing what information suits them and then ignoring anything that doesn't quite fit their narrative. So the internet, obviously, and social media companies are designed in a way that allow you to fall down these rabbit holes quite easily. And algorithms are designed to push you towards more content that would match your interests. I also spoke to Katie. Katie is studying for a master's, and she too has noticed some people she knows have also gone down COVID conspiracy theory rabbit holes. I began by asking Katie, how does she respond when she hears people around her express these views?
I was just kind of asking, like, why? Where are you getting this information from? Who said that? You know, because some fella said it on Facebook who's sitting in a dark room doesn't mean it's true.
Isn't the worrying thing, Katie, how for some people the far-fetched has now become the reality, if you like, in their
yeah.
mind?
Obviously, with the likes of Facebook and stuff, you can just go on and you can generally kind of write whatever you want. And I know now they have changed, and you mentioned like COVID, especially on Instagram, it'll say for the latest information, click here and it'll bring you to the HC or whatever.
Yeah.
So they are trying to stop it, but I think it's still very much kind of, you can just say what you want.
So it must be very interesting for you to see people you've known all your life suddenly, you know, accepting at face value some pretty radical views.
So I've always been brought up to be questioning things and to say, well, okay, is it coming from a reliable source or is it just coming from some random fella on Facebook? One friend in particular would be quite suspicious of the whole thing. We just kind of think, oh, look, there he's kind of off again. But I won't say we avoid it, but I'll like question him and he'll come back with something else. And then it's just kind of, we go around and around, but doesn't really get anywhere.
Facts have become so disputed.
You can't really argue with facts that much either. I mean, unless you've gone to study, you know, human biology or chemistry or something, you know.
Well, sure, everybody on Twitter has a PhD in one of the sciences, don't they?
Brian O'Connell talking to Katie there, and then he was talking about some of the research around these conspiracy theories.
The lockdown has impacted people profoundly, I suppose, the longer it goes on, and I'm sure we all know people whose otherwise rational views have become irrational. Now, I was looking for some data around this, and I came across work carried out by Dr. Joanne McVeigh in Maynooth University. She's pointed to a recent study on the profile of conspiracy theorists, and it was found actually that younger rather than older individuals, people with a lower level of education, people in employment rather than students, all more likely to believe in conspiracy theory explanations, as well as people who would perhaps be economically disadvantaged. Someone who knows a lot about this area is Aoife Gallagher. She's an analyst for the Institute for Strategic Dialogue. And Aoife believes that the level of disinformation has multiplied over the past year. And she's also issued Claire a word of caution in relation to the political direction of some of these groups.
I think before the pandemic, we wouldn't really have been used to this level of disinformation that we'd see online. Conspiratorial thinking increases when people feel uncertain or when they feel angry or scared or just distrustful. So the pandemic has really, it's kind of created a perfect storm for conspiracy theories to take hold. The issue isn't with people asking questions, it's actually where they're going for the answers. And then the prevailing theme really among a lot of the people within these groups is that the pandemic is all part of a plot by governments to control their populations. You know, conspiracy theories tend to give people simple solutions to very complicated situations.
And I suppose, isn't it a factor too, Aoife, that people are having less contact with real people in real life? They're more inclined to form these kinships online than they mightn't have before.
Yeah, exactly. And when I talk about, you know, anti-lockdown communities, that's exactly what they are. They are communities.
I mean, it's such a hard one, isn't it, if you have a close friend or if you have a family member who's gone down one of these rabbit holes?
Yeah, I mean, it is very difficult, to be honest. And, you know, the default reaction, I think, for a lot of people is to call people crazy and call people stupid and things like that. And that is the opposite, really, of what you should be doing, because that's just going to push people away further. What you often find is that, you know, either people that believe in conspiracy theories or people that don't, they often have the same anxiety. I think trying to reach a level of, you know, saying to someone, yes, I'm worried about that as well. What do you think is going on? Okay, well, here's what I think is going on. And getting them to question their own belief systems in some ways.
And you'd have to say the social media companies were very slow to put in explainers and to put in fact checks, weren't they?
I don't know, in some ways, I think that is a bit of a game of whack-a-mole and you're putting a plaster on a gushing wound when you're, you know, doing things like that. The issue is with their business model. They find the content that keeps people glued to screens, which is things like conspiracy theories, things that make people kind of angry and anxious and make people kind of want to find out more. So that's really the issue when it comes to the platforms.
And to what extent, Aoife, is this just a moment in time, do you think?
I think that's a good question. And I often don't really like to speculate about what the future holds. I think that I've been looking at these movements specifically in a US context, really, for the past number of years. I would have worries and anxieties about these movements leading people towards more extremist movements. You know, the COVID skeptic and anti-lockdown movement, they would never consider themselves to be far right, and they're not far right. But at the end of the day, what I'm seeing within these groups is that they are consuming far right content.
Aoife Gallagher from Brian O'Connell's report for Today with Claire Byrne. And on Morning Ireland, Paul Cunningham was looking back on the Chernobyl tragedy 35 years after the nuclear disaster. His interviews from 15 years ago are also part of the report.
The first day I worked there, I got a high radiation dose. I came back in the evening and my wife said, my T-shirt immediately light.
Valentin Masolyuk was a liquidator, one of more than 500,000 people involved in the cleanup efforts at Chernobyl. When I met Valentin, he was being treated for cancer.
Practically everyone is sick. Many of my friends have already died. They seem to be healthy, and then you hear they died. Why?
Many of the people I met in 2006 were ill. That included Colonel Oleg Chichkov, who flew choppers over the burning nuclear plant. For 10 days, he dropped lead, dolomite, boric acid, cement and earth into the exposed reactor core. For him, orders were orders.
People knew what the atom was. We were given an order. I was a military pilot. I understood my responsibility as a senior officer. We had to do it as soon as possible and well.
But others, like firefighter Viktor Petrukhno, tell me they were not given appropriate protection.
We extinguished fires without any personal protection. We had no respirators, no gas masks, no special clothes. We had nothing.
People living nearby were not told of the dangers immediately either. Ivan Mozichenko was one of those unknowingly exposed to radiation.
Immediately after the explosion, we felt a bitter taste in our mouth. Back then, we didn't know why. You would come home to eat and you would feel bitterness.
After a few days, nearby areas were evacuated. Some people refused to leave their remote villages. Others returned after unhappy experiences of living in cities. People like Nadia Petrukhno.
Well, we hope that it's okay to eat them. We eat everything that we grow in our garden, onions, potatoes, carrots, beetroots. People have been living here for many years.
Chernobyl triggered psychological as well as physical damage. Vladimir Kozelyev told me when his mother died, his father simply gave up.
My father was supposed to have a blood transfusion. He was sick. He refused to do it. He said he didn't want to live any longer and to bury him in the village.
One area of agreement I found was the warmth of the affection in southern Belarus for Irish help through Chernobyl Children International. It's not just the more than 100 million euro in aid, or the 25,000 children from the wider Chernobyl area travelled to Ireland for rest and recuperation, but also life-saving cardiac surgery. In 2006, I met Vitaly, who was a 9-year-old boy 12 years previously, had pleaded to Chernobyl Children International founder Eddie Roach from his hospital bed to save him from a heart condition caused by radioactive cesium.
You shouted out in Russian, please take me to your country.
Yeah.
I will die.
I remember that all the time. Yeah.
Vitaly and a younger child, Sasha, became the first children from Belarus to travel to Ireland for medical treatment.
In the Belarusian, lots of snow. I'm going to Ireland, it's amazing. It's just only raining, no snow, green grass. It's, I don't know, amazing.
The other child, Sasha, told me how that life-saving operation in Ireland determined his future.
I tried to go to university to be a doctor.
Why do you want to become a doctor?
Because doctors saved my life. So I want to save the lives as well.
On this, the 35th anniversary, I asked Adi Roach what her priorities were so many years after disaster struck at Chernobyl.
We've been honoured today by the President of Ireland in recognising the pioneering work that Ireland has done. We're acknowledging the volunteerism of Ireland today. And of course, in the opposite direction, we are sending this wonderful lifeline to the victims and survivors. And with a global voice led by the President of Ireland, we are saying clearly to the victims and survivors, we will not forget you.
Paul Cunningham's report on Morning Ireland. And if you'd like to know more about Chernobyl, Paul's blog is posted on the RTE News website. Now, it's one of the big podcasts of the moment. The Gun Plot looks at the arms crisis of 1970. On Today with Claire Byrne, Ronan Kelly and Nicolene Greer are the creators. And Nicolene started by telling Claire about the interest from people in this story that's 50 years old.
People seem to be interested in it, even though it is such an old story, if you like.
So it's so dramatic. And the reason it's so dramatic is because, Ronan, of the audio that you've managed to get hold of.
Yeah, what happened about 2 years ago was that Michael Heaney, who is a former TV producer, was working on a PhD and subsequently a book called The Plot That Never Was about the arms crisis. And he interviewed a barrister who was on the case at the time in 1970. And during the interview, the barrister took out some audio tapes and he said, I don't know if he knew it, but they recorded this case, and here's some tapes that were given to me as a souvenir. So summer 2019, Michael came to us with these tapes, and he said, you may be interested. And we thought we'd make a one-off documentary. We thought it'd be fascinating. You know, the sound of the courtroom from back then, the quality's actually pretty good, the sounds of the accents of the barristers. There's a certain amount of melodrama from the barristers, as you can imagine. And we went to the courts, and the court said, you have permission to use them. And then when we did some research into the story, we decided we'd make a podcast out of it, because at that time we had a podcast, a hugely successful podcast called The Nobody's Own Running, and we thought this could make a podcast too. And interestingly, Nicolene was talking about the charts. One of the charts that's doing very well is Spotify, and that's mostly for younger people. And I think the reason for that is that a lot of younger people studied this in school and are revisiting it, whereas people like me, I'm in my 50s, I didn't study it in school. I was only 7 when it happened, and it's a lot of it is totally new to me. So for people younger than me, it's revisiting a story they heard about in school.
Well, I'd love people to hear some of that extraordinary audio now. And audio aired from inside an Irish courtroom, which, as you say, Roland, is a first for Irish broadcasting. Let's take a listen to some of those proceedings. This is Seamus McKenna, senior counsel for the prosecution, cross-examining Captain Kelly.
I was awaiting.
Right.
I was awaiting instructions as regards boss man. It would refer to Mr. Haughey, I would imagine, but I was not one bit worried whom he went to once he got the instructions.
Oh, now, do you want to go back on what you conceded?
I am not going back on anything. I wanted to get instructions from an official source back in Dublin.
You meant, I suggest, when you made that telephone call, this and this only, that Mr. Haughey would be asked for the final okay.
Well, this is what I assumed that he would ask Mr. Haughey.
Not ask me to assume anything. I asked you, was that what you meant?
Oh, yes, I meant him to go ask Mr. Haughey.
A final okay from Mr. Haughey?
Yes. A final okay. I asked for instructions and I said, ask the boss man, which was Mr. Haughey.
That is something else to hear that. Nicolene, will you tell us a little bit about Captain Kelly, the man who was being cross-examined there?
Yes, well, that was Irish Army Captain Kelly. He was one of the 5 men who were accused originally of this so-called plot at the time, along with Ministers Charles Haughey and Neil Blaney. The other 2 people that were on trial were John Kelly, who's in the IRA, and a businessman, Albert Likes. Captain James Kelly, we actually start the podcast, I suppose, looking at it through his eyes. The podcast, the first of public news, as you say, was that May 1970, when the 2 government ministers were dramatically sacked, and that led to the trials and the subsequent, fallout from that. But we go back in the podcast right to the year before, to August 1969, in Derry, which was really the events that kicked off the whole thing, the Battle of the Bogside. And Captain James Kelly had happened to be there on leave, as it happened, but saw the whole events happen. before him, and came back and reported that to his superior officer, Colonel Michael Heffernan, and then subsequently started meeting with Neil Blaney primarily, because Neil Blaney and Charles Haughey had been put in charge of a subcommittee and given £100,000 for the relief of the North. Mm. So that was really how he became involved with the whole affair. And he was the man on the ground for Neil Blaney and Charles Haughey, meeting with people in the North, trying to find out what it was that they were saying they needed. And that was mainly guns.
Nicolene Greer and Ronan Kelly, creators of the podcast Gunplot, from Today with Claire Byrne. And in the morning, some outdoor sports back on the menu, and Kieran Mullooly was reporting from County Longford Golf Club.
Greetings to you from the sunshine at County Longford Golf Club. They've been playing golf here since 1894. I'm looking out at glorious sunshine on the first tee this morning, and to my right I can see them coming in on the 18th. It's been a very busy morning. A lot of frustration here over the last number of months, but they're very pleased to be back. In a moment I'll be hearing not only about Longford but the situation around the country with Mark Kennelly here, Chief Executive of Golfing Ireland. But firstly, this morning I got an opportunity to speak to people as they began to play. Just after 7 o'clock they were there on the course. We'll be hearing shortly from Colm Hughes, who's the captain here in Longford, but I had a word with some of those teeing off in the early hours this morning.
Oh, the last 4 months has been very, very tough. Very tough on our members, because we're expecting them to keep paying their sub and support us, so, which they all did, and thanks very much to the members. So they're looking forward to get back into fairways and play golf, and that's the long and the short of it.
Oh, sure, exhilarating. You wouldn't get me up at this hour of the morning for anything else.
So, and how have you missed it?
I've missed it, especially since the good weather came in. But I kept myself busy in the garden and in the house and whatnot, never looking as well. So we have all COVID gardens, COVID houses, etc. But yes, it was sad not being able to come down here.
Great to be back here in County Longford Golf Club. We've missed it. 120 days, I think, now since we had the opportunity to hit a ball. Looking forward to a whole summer of golf here in Ireland's Hidden Heartlands.
What have you been after the last 120 days?
My wife has been very happy anyhow, because I've been cleaning out the attic and cleaning out sheds and cutting grass and painting walls, and that's all gone to the back burner now until hopefully we won't have a fourth wave of COVID.
Exactly.
It's tremendous to be back here in on the first tee, hitting off. Myself and Gary here now, and we look forward to 18 wonderful holes.
Yeah, that's some of the members of County Longford Golf are going out this morning after 7. I'd say there's probably over a dozen on the course at this stage. Annette Kane is the lady captain here. She's not out yet. She's beside me here, sitting looking out on the fairway of the first. And I suppose, firstly, there's one other point, I suppose. Apart from the golf, there's the social side of everything that's been missed over the last number of months.
Absolutely. People are beside themselves, you know, with frustration, I suppose, waiting to get out and play at a safe distance. It's a game that's easily played with distance and solo or any other way. And it's great to see so many out this morning.
Kieran Mullooly's report for Morning Ireland. Then later, Claire Byrne was talking to Jenny Branigan, chartered physiotherapist, about being match fit for getting back out there on the golf course or the tennis court.
The message today, on this positive day, everybody is delighted. We're all dusting off the golf clubs and trying to find the kids' gum shields again. But the message today is to give your body time to adapt. And in actual fact, it's quite like the message that we give out when it's New Year's and it's New Year's resolution time. We're trying to make sure that people plan their return, they prepare their bodies for return, and then they recover as they return.
Yeah, because even though you may have been walking a lot or running a lot, the types of movements you'll be doing if you're playing golf or tennis or any of the other outdoor sports that will be allowed from today, they're quite different movements. So you could be in trouble if you feel you're as fit as you were.
That's exactly it. And I've been speaking to my patients about this in the last 2 or 3 weeks. And while the 100 days of walking has been a brilliant initiative, or you're doing your 10,000 steps a day, you have to think about the intensity of the movement that you have to do when you're on a golf course
when you're on a tennis court. Think about those short, sharp sprints. Think about being able to accelerate quickly to the net or change direction, pushing off each foot as you sidestep. Think about then in golf, you need to be able to twist your spine. Think about Dimpna with her lawn bowl. She needs to be able to bend over and she needs to be able to lunge down to throw that ball. So again, there's lots of different types of movements that need to be incorporated that you may not have been doing during the lockdown period.
Jenny Brannigan from Today with Claire Byrne. Now, I think for most of us, the pandemic has been a long, worrying and difficult time. But for some, it's been a time of opportunity, rest and self-discovery. Beth O'Halloran is an artist and writer based in Dublin, and Erica Bracken is a freelance PR consultant and copywriter based in Cork. They both spoke to Claire.
Erica, I'm going to start with you because you had up until March last year the sort of typical life of a young professional in Dublin. It was work, coffee, gym, commute, all of those things that occupied our days up to that point.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Claire. Hi, Beth. Absolutely. That sounds like a flashback in time, Claire. I suppose it was just all whipped away without even recognising what I had. But I guess my decision to move from Dublin to Cork was, it was a lot less a conscious decision at the start and quite reactive, I guess. The lockdown was announced. I was revealed that I'd be working from home for a significant period of time. So it was a no-brainer to kind of move back to Cork, where I'd have the comfort of space and the luxury space and the comfort of my family, and just get out of the city, the small apartment where I was living. It just, the city kind of lost its appeal, I guess, for a lot of people. And it initially was that, it was going to be 3 weeks, then it was 3 months. I found myself here a year, and now it's kind of looking like it's pretty indefinite. Mm-hmm. But I think
you were working for yourself, weren't you? So you could make that decision without having to consult anyone, really.
So actually at the time I was working for a large corporate PR firm. So I was working from home up until March, within that system. So I had that flexibility, which was great. But I guess for me, what COVID did is it provided that break in the pattern. So as you said, I was living to work. I was coming home, four or five times a year, some years. And that rat race of commute, work, commute, home just to eat and sleep and then repeating it again. And so I came home and suddenly my eyes were just opened to the fact that, I didn't have to live life that way, and that I think it kind of showed me that there were options and that I had, I had a bit of freedom and time and space to kind of think, right, how do I actually want to live my life? And do I want to continue on blindly climbing the ladder, just living for the weekend? So I've kind of made, some fairly transformative changes over the past couple of months in particular. So as I said, I was working with a corporate PR firm. I've since gone freelance. I'm, perfectly, making money here working at home, but at the same time saving money because I'm not paying insane Dublin rents every month. I'm doing my yoga teacher training on the side. I'm really thinking about my options going forward. I'm applying for further education. And obviously one of the biggest things for me is just the complete immersion in family life. Like, as I said, I was seeing my family rarely, fleeting weekends here and there. And now I'm all in.
And that's going OK, is it? You're not all on top of each other and not on each other's nerves.
Very lucky to get on with everyone, and getting to see my niece grow up it's just such a rare opportunity that I didn't even think was an option for me.
And Beth O'Halloran felt the positive aspects of the lockdown because of her experience living in Japan.
Yeah, I was living in a Zen monastery in the tiny little rural place in the hills of Japan, but similar to what Erica was saying, the way COVID has been a sort of slowly expanding block of time. I went to Japan thinking I was just going to be there for a few months, and then it just sort of grew into 3 years of that experience.
And do you feel that living that life in Japan then prepared you very well for the lockdown of the pandemic?
I do. I mean, it's funny because it can sound like such an esoteric thing. You're going, the place was like a 300-year-old monastery, like exactly like you see in the films. But really, there was no great mystery to what we were doing, where you're just sitting on a cushion, kind of in these ideal circumstances for mindfulness with lovely incense, and you know, the light was beautiful and the air was really clear, and you didn't have to do anything, as in like rush off to work and teach and earn money and things. But I think the thing that it mostly prepared me for like the lockdown experience was just learning how to sit through discomfort. You know, like you have to sit on the cushion, and sometimes you're there for many, many hours. Sometimes it's up to 18 hours a day, which kind of sounds a bit mad.
Meditating, is it, for 18
yeah,
hours? Oh my gosh.
Hours,
if I managed 18 minutes, I'd be giving myself a medal.
Well, that can be a long time in the current situation. Yeah, but you know, sure, you're getting, it's drip by drip. You get used to it, but then at times, certainly, your knees would just fall like they would feel like they were listening to. And it's those times where they'd say, well, just, you know it's going to end. You're always, it was always in 25-minute segments of time. So you get to move your legs in between. And you just kind of think, yes, I can bear this. I know the bell will ring, although sometimes you wouldn't be sure of it.
Sounds like torture, Beth. Sorry now, but like, yeah, 18 hours with a break every 25 minutes. It doesn't sound like fun.
Honestly, and I promise I wasn't a complete wingnut. It's because you're in this incredibly lovely place. And as I say, the whole routine of the day is set up for that. And you're getting up like crazy o'clock, and you just get to watch the dawn light just slowly coming into the room. And it's sitting there so quiet and so still that even like the sound of a moth would seem like a big event. And I feel like in a way that's what COVID has done to me, where our world just became so small and so quiet that then we all became more and more sensitized to things like the cherry blossoms. I mean, I just feel like everybody's really made a fuss about those this year, I think, because we needed something to cheer us up. But also we're just so much more aware because we're all going on our daily walks and you're noticing those little changes a lot more.
I'm sure when you came back from Japan that you missed the quiet of those moments and that existence. So are you saying then that when the pandemic happened, you felt a little bit of that calm again?
Yes, I really did. I think because I worked so many different jobs and I've got two kids and it's just a really busy, busy time, that there was something about just pulling up the bridge and just, you know, closing the windows for a little while, and then everything just went very, very quiet. And I did remember that sense. And as that quietness kicked in, a different sort of sensitivity kicked in as well, that would give you the respite from the anxiety of this strange time. Like as you got more and more stressed about, you know, your hands touching something, you're also really aware that your hands were touching something. So it kind of brought you into the present moment as well as the thundering anxiety that came with it. There is sort of this other thing.
Do you keep up the meditation, Beth?
Yeah. Do I? I do, Claire. I do in much smaller doses. But yeah, we have a centre here in Dublin, actually on Haytree Street, and we're meeting at the minute online every Tuesday and Thursday. So that's actually been lovely to kind of sit, the strange thing of sitting in silence with a Zoom call.
No, doesn't matter if you're on mute, right?
Yeah, exactly. No one will judge.
Beth O'Halloran and Erica Bracken from Today with Claire Byrne. And that's it for Playback Dailies. So mind yourself, till next time.